also coming?
I thought Lauren was coming. Oh. You're thinking that other girl was coming?
Yes.
She usually comes. He had said that he would.
Oh, so she okay. Let me wait, it's okay.
So, Rabbi, what did you think about the ruling not to allow Jerusalem on their passports?
Well, you know, obviously, I think it's a wrong result.
Right.
But in terms of pure legal analysis, I can't say it's wrong because under the law of the United States, you know, the president does have a lot of authority over foreign affairs, and Congress normally.
Oh, because it was considered foreign policy.
That was the issue. The issue basically was that even though Congress passed the law,
the
president overruled it, and in foreign affairs, he has this zechus.
Right to overrule law.
Well,
because didn't they say that the capital should, the embassy should be moved because this is, should be recognized?
That's correct. But the argument goes that since it's a foreign affairs issue, the president is kind of the exclusive determiner of foreign affairs.
Even though Congress had said that.
Yeah, so Congress had no right to say it. That's basically.
Is that what they were saying?
So, you know, the president, I think, is absolutely wrong in making the decision.
Yes,
but
yes.
In terms of the legalities of who gets to make the decision. Yes. I think it's a justifiable result.
It's
so it's one of those things where, you know, bad results, but legally
legal.
It's sustainable.
Yes.
That's the issue, I think. Okay.
What's interesting, Jeffrey Haldeman pointed this out.
Yeah.
His basis for the decision, being the president, is he doesn't want to prejudice the outcome of negotiations between two parties. So if he were to abide by that, strictly from the point of view of both sides.
Yeah.
It would be a good thing.
Right, well, yes.
Well, yes.
Listen, we just have another, year and a half of Obama left. And God willing, either Mashiach will come, hopefully, or if not, we'll have somebody better.
Nothing coming down the pipe that's better.
Well, yeah. All right.
Mario.
Okay.
Was it Marco
Marco Rubio.
As a Florida resident, I would never vote.
All right.
Okay. Okay. Anyway, we have the parsha of Gazdos Chukas HaTorah, which has the mystery of the Parah Aduma. That's considered to be the most enigmatic law of the Torah. And remember, the Parah Aduma is an absolute condition. If a person has Tumas Meis, there is no way they can be purified unless they're sprinkled with the ashes of the Parah Aduma. And that is the technical reason why most religious Jews do not go in the Harabayas, because technically, although the outer rim of the Harabayas is only Machane Leviyah, and a Tamei Meis could go in Machane Leviyah, and that's why those who go are willing to make that judgment, but most of the poskim say that we're simply uncertain where is the Makom HaMikdash and where is the outer perimeter. And for a Tamei Meis to enter the Makom HaMikdash is a Chi of Kares. It's a Chi of Kares Mamish, and therefore Misafik we don't enter. So again, there's no machlokas in principle between the Makilim and the Machmirim. I mean, everybody admits that the part of the Harabayat that is simply Machane Leviyah is permitted, and everybody admits the part that is Machane Shechiyah is forbidden. There's no machlokas here, but the machlokas simply is, how confident are you in your ability to identify where is the actual Azara, the actual courtyard of the temple. So, you know, as you know, archaeologists themselves are in various disagreements, and there's all sorts of uncertainties. Where is the Mizbeach? Where is the Kodesh HaKadoshim, etc.? So the Dati Liyumi Poskim Hu Matir, which does not include the Rabbanut answers, although it's not clear if the Rabbanut is motivated by halacha or politics. It's not clear because politically it may not be a wise idea to go on the Harabayas. The Dati Liyumi Poskim Hu Matir are simply more confident in their identification of what is the Azara. That's all. So it's not really a machlokas in principle, although it does have radical ramifications. It's an interesting circular problem, and that is, we cannot be tahor until we are sprinkled with the afer of the Parah Aduma mixed in water. Now the question is, though, in order to make a Parah Aduma, in order to effect a Parah Aduma, and in order to sprinkle it, you have to have an ish tahor, a person that's tahor. So let's imagine that we've discovered a Parah Aduma, which indeed we have. I believe in the Lakewood area, there's a non-Jewish family that that owns a Parah Aduma in an undisclosed location, and they are in contact with rabbis and the like to be sure that it doesn't become puzzle. Because a Parah Aduma can very easily become puzzle, not only by an extra black hair, which you can't control, but, for example, if you did any work with it, if you had it pull a wagon, even for 1 second, if it had intercourse, sexual intercourse with a bull, that would disqualify it. Even if I leaned on it, that would be called putting a yoke on it. So one has to be very, very careful not to do anything that would disqualify it. But let's say we have the Parah Aduma. But who is going to be able to prepare it? If all of us are Tamei Nes, all of us, we assume, are Tamei Nes. So there's nobody who could prepare a Parah Aduma without being sprinkled with the ashes by an Ish Tahor. So we have this circular problem. So the way we break the circle is that Eliyahu HaNavi is going to come before Mashiach. Eliyahu HaNavi is a Kohen. Eliyahu HaNavi is Tahor. He will have with him the remnants of the last Parah Aduma, the ninth Parah Aduma, the ninth. And he will sprinkle it on selected Kohanim, who will then be ritually pure to prepare the tenth Parah Aduma. That way, that's how you break the circle with the coming of Eliyahu HaNavi. Otherwise, you really have a dilemma. There would be no way to make a Parah Aduma because all of us are coming. Yes, so the alternative method is to raise children under conditions where there was no possibility that they ever came in contact with the dead. Now, that's an extreme measure, because even if you're walking in the soil, we say there might be dead bodies under you and the tumah goes up. Okay. So the only way you could raise a child is to take him to an area that is a solid rock cliff, etc. And the Gemara actually discusses this. And they can't come in contact with other people, and they're fed like the kids in hospitals and incubators. And the like.
From a practical point of view, though,
yeah,
that would mean that, okay, somebody undergoes the process of tahara.
Right.
And then seconds later, they could become tamei again because they're walking as they...
That is correct. That
so
is
how
correct.
Do you...
Well, in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, when we were more careful about this, there were certain streets that were muhsak as tahor. In fact, the Gemara even discusses, don't walk in certain neighborhoods you could walk. We've lost that now.
Underground passages from the Temple Mount, because below the surface of the ground, they
Well, obviously, the problem basically is Tumah rises vertically to an infinite height. That's the problem of the airplane. The airplane that flies over the cemetery, the tumah goes up. It does not spread horizontally unless you're under a tent. If I'm under the roof with a dead body, it spreads horizontally. If I'm not under a roof, it only rises vertically. But it rises vertically at no matter what the height is. That's why Kohanim cannot fly.
That's why below ground level.
Well, below ground also, it would depend. It's a complicated thing. Just as tumah goes straight up, tumah also goes straight down. But it can be blocked if you're in a structure. So if I'm in a house, let's say I'm in a house, and there's a dead body on the roof of this house, the tumah does not penetrate. The house blocks it.
So if there was a tunnel built underneath...
So a tunnel could block. On the other hand, you have to be afraid about the dead bodies under the tunnel and the like. So Eliyahu HaNavi is going to break the conundrum, so to speak. Now, if you think about this, think about how many people needed to use the Parah Aduma every year. Now, normally, I could go through most of my life being Tamei. That's not a problem. But for the Shalosh Regalim, where people had to go into the Beis HaMikdash, they were obligated to purify themselves. So you had hundreds of thousands, if not millions of Jews, who needed to be sprinkled 3 times a year. With the ashes and water of the Parah Aduma. And the duration that this ceremony was performed was probably 1,600 years, if you count the years of the Mikdash, and it even continued after the Beis HaMikdash. So 1,600 years.
Excuse me, after the Beis HaMikdash?
Yes. Parah Aduma ritual continued after the Beis HaMikdash as well. It does not depend. You can't make a Parah Aduma unless you have the Beis HaMikdash, but the Hazaah, the sprinkling, does not require a Mikdash. It continued into the time of the Amoraim.
And people did it because?
Because they wanted to be ritually pure, because many, many Chachamim wanted to be ritually pure. But again, you probably did not have millions of people doing it, but certainly during the time of the Beis HaMikdash. So you had like millions of people over a period of certainly more than 1,000 years, and yet Chazal teach us that there were only 9 parot adumot. The 10th one will be for Mashiach. Only 9 were used. So it's quite amazing that miraculously those ashes lasted for all of the people that needed them. Now, just to clarify to address a misconception, Hazaah, the ritual sprinkling, has to be done by a Kohen. Yes, but it doesn't have to be done in Yerushalayim. It doesn't have to be done in the temple. They used to divide the ashes and create regional purification centers. So some ashes would be in Haifa, and some ashes would be in Tzfat, some ashes would be in Beersheba. So if you needed to be Tahor, for example, you were a Kohen who had to eat Truma, and the like, so even if you weren't going to the Beis HaMikdash, or whatever it would be, you could go to your local regional center and get sprinkled. There was no requirement. It was not centralized in the Beis HaMikdash itself, although the initial preparation of the red heifer had to be, it was not in the Beis HaMikdash, but it was on Har HaZeitim. The Parah Adumah was burnt on Har HaZeitim, facing the Beis HaMikdash and the like. So it really was quite miraculous. And of course, everyone knows that if you had a Parah Adumah, you could get a lot of money from it. You recall the famous story in Maseches Kedushin of Dama ben Nisina, was a goy from Ashkelon. And initially he had a jewel that was needed for the Kohen Gadol's Choshen. And Chachamim wanted to pay a lot of money, but the key to the jewelry box was under his father's pillow, and his father was asleep. So he refused to wake his father to obtain the key. As a result, he lost the deal. But it is said the next year, God rewarded him by giving him a Parah Adumah in his flock. And they offered him even more money than the jewel, but he did not want to take more money. He said, just give me the money he would have given me for the jewel. But the Gemara uses that as the exemplar of the highest level of honoring a parent. Although, halachically, it's a very problematical example. I mean, let's imagine this practically. Let's say my father is sleeping. There's a key under his pillow. And somebody offers me $6 million if I retrieve the thing with the key, and I say, nope, I'm not waking Abba. So when Abba wakes up and he hears that, you know, Dad, we could have gotten $6 million, Dad would not be happy. Dad might be quite furious. You idiot, you know, you forfeited $6 million. Wake me up! So halachically, if you know your father would want to be woken up, you do wake him up. So you have to understand, the Gemara is not citing the story as an example of what halachically is proper. But it is simply citing the story in terms of the devotion that a son has to a parent. He made the wrong decision, but he was willing to lose whatever the amount of money was, $6 million, let's say, in order to honor his parents. So it's kind of, the Gemara is citing the story for attitude, not for actual behavior. The actual behavior is problematic. We would actually behave in a different way. But so Parah Adumahs could be big business because they were rare. Again, another misconception. Maybe it's obvious, but for when I was a kid, yeah, maybe even until recently, I always had this image of a Parah Adumah looking like a fire truck red. Mm-hmm. And if that's the case, then, you know, it really would be a miracle, because that is not a color that occurs in cows naturally. But when I saw this picture of the Parah Adumah, it was illuminating. It's simply the orange-brown that's a very common color in cows. It's not a rare color. What's rare is that it's 100%, you don't have more than one black hair, etc. But the actual color is a standard cow brown. So Adumah does not really mean firehouse red. It refers to brownie.
And did it have to be checked on an ongoing basis to make sure that a black or a white
ear? Yes, indeed. Now, once you shecht it, no changes are going to happen. I say that's fine, but until you shecht it, you have to check it. Yeah, you have to check it. And, that's been a recurring problem. There is a discussion, could you create a Parah Adumah through genetic engineering or cloning, and would it be halachically acceptable? Because in nature, you might not be able to get that 100%, but through selective gene splicing and the like, you might take out or put in any genetic material that would facilitate the requisite redness. So people discuss that, whether it would be permitted or not. I don't know if there's an actual psak on it. I don't see why not. Say again?
What should be used?
Yeah, I'm not sure what the problem would be. I'm not aware of any problem with it.
Cloning alone is also
animal cloning is certainly permitted.
Yeah.
Maybe even human cloning is permitted. It's not clear, but animal cloning alone. Once you have a paradigma, you can keep on getting it. But cloning alone is not going to get you a paradigma.
No.
So what you do is you have to combine genetic engineering, and then you clone the genetically engineered either embryo and the like, and then you can get, you can run off paraduma like you run off Xeroxes. So initially, though, you do have to do genetic engineering for the first one.
No, I'm far from an expert on the subject, but I remember reading that the markings of an animal are not determined entirely by genes, that there are totally random elements in the formation of the embryo that determine the marking of the animal. So even if you cloned a totally red cow, you wouldn't necessarily get a red offspring.
Well, that would be interesting. In other words, there are mutations that occur.
They're not mutations.
They're not even connected to genes at all, you mean?
Yes, exactly.
That's very interesting.
Well, we all know that. We see examples of that in the distribution of markings. From the same litter, you can have a dozen dogs, we can say brown and white spots, but the brown and white is distributed in different proportions on their bodies. This is not a result of genes. This is a result of some randomized
hormone or chemicals or whatever, even responses to the environment. This dog was in the sun half an hour longer or something like that. Okay, well, you're right. So that shows you that another lesson that man cannot control his fate, meaning to say things are going to be left up to God with all of our science and our technology, which is always an important lesson to learn. Now, we know that the Parsha begins, when the Parsha describes Parah Adumah, it calls it Chok, Zos Chukas HaTorah, and it's well known that Chok is the particular word the Torah uses for the commandments that are inexplicable, that are irrational from our perspective. We believe everything has a reason, but we cannot necessarily penetrate what it is, as opposed to mishpat, which refers to what Rav Sadra Gaon called mitzvot sichliot, mitzvot that the reason would come to. Paraduma is an inexplicable mitzvah, and in particular, the whole ritual is inexplicable, but in particular, the part that makes it most inexplicable is the notion of paradox, because there is a halacha called mitaheres atahorim asatmeim, that if I'm tamei, the ashes of the para purify me, and yet all the people that handle those ashes, they do become tamei. So the same thing that is a vehicle of purification becomes a vehicle of contamination.
So in other words, the one who administers.
Well, okay, so it's a little more complicated, because now the Torah itself says that he who sprinkles the ashes with the water mix becomes tamei. And yet, Chazal say that's not actually true. The actual sprinkler does not become tamei, but it means he who... Huh?
The one who mixes it,
and the one who carries it. So you become tamei by carrying the paraduma mixture, which is ashes and water, and the one who mixes it becomes tamei. The actual sprinkler...
Did you have to be sprinkled?
Oh, okay. So now this raises another question, because people sometimes think this creates what you might call an infinite regression problem, because if I'm tamei and I need to be sprinkled, and the people who handle it become tamei and they need to be sprinkled, you'll never have people who are going to be totally pure, because there'll always be some guy literally holding the bag. But that's not a problem, exactly for the reason that you said, and that is the tumah that one gets because they handled or they mixed or they carried the paraduma ashes is not in itself a tumah that requires being sprinkled with the ashes, because it's not tumah from a dead body. Remember, there are many types of tumah in the Torah, And but it's only the tumah from a dead body that requires paraduma. A nida does not need, of course, paraduma. If I touch a dead animal, I don't need paraduma. And similarly, the tumah of carrying the mechatas, it's called.
How do you rationalize that distinction between the sprinkling and the ones who prepare?
Yeah, well, that's a, you know, it is a good question. I mean, it's based on darshaning different psukim, but I think that maybe the message is that it's like, you know, there's a certain amount of gratitude to the person who made you pure, so the Torah is not going to make him impure. It would be a little unfair. Although, in the Chassidish books, they say that the secret of Para Aduma, the purification power of Para Aduma, comes out of Avas Yisrael. Why is that so? Because, let's say I'm a Kohen, in my desire to make you Tahor, the people that handle it, they themselves become Tamei. So the purification of the Para Aduma is when one Jew is willing to inconvenience himself to his own detriment to help another, that brings purity into the world. Meaning to say, instead of looking at it as a paradox, it actually is a cause and effect. Because I am willing to make myself tamei on your behalf, that brings purity into the world. That's the idea of Avas Yisrael.
It's all on the tumos, you know, yeah. And the other tumos, he goes to the mikvah, it's a solitary act.
Yeah.
And the paraduma, it's a joint
communal
action.
That's right. That's correct. That's correct. Every other tumah, except for tumat meis, and maybe, well, saras is different. Saras has korbanos. But generally speaking, mikvah is the only thing that you need. Mikvah is indeed a solitary act. This would combined with this Hasidic Hitzot of Abbas Yisrael.
That's right,
very good.
What's the Hasidic connection?
No, the Hasidic connection is that's what I just said, that the concept of why the Para Aduma purifies is precisely because the Kohen is willing to take the detriment of becoming impure. And when one Jew is willing to give up and sacrifice for the benefit of another Jew, that brings purity into the world. So we just added from Rav Soloveitchik that it's notable that Para Aduma is the only purification ritual that requires a concept of community. In fact, it's not just two people. It's not just the person who needs it and the Kohen who sprinkles it, but there was a whole community that needed to produce this Para Aduma. By definition, unlike the mikveh, which is a solitary action, this is a community-based action. And indeed, that's why Tomei Meis is the most chomor level of Tumah, and it requires that Achdus and Avam Yisrael to be able to affect your... Chomor is severe, strict. Tomei Meis is the only, well, not the only Tumah, but it's one of the few Tumahs that are 7 days. The standard Tumah of a touch of dead animal or a seminal emission is only 1 day. Most Tumahs, all I need is mikveh. Here I also need mikvah, on this, but I need to be sprinkled twice on day 3 and day 7 with the mayim of the Para Aduma. So the idea of chok is a very interesting idea. The Mefarshim asks, start off with a relatively small question, but it has interesting repercussions. Why is it called chukas ha-Torah? This is not a chok of the whole Torah, this is a chok of the Para Aduma. So it should say, zos chukas hapara. Why do you universalize it to Torah? And the suggestion that the Mefarshim give is because there is something characteristic in this limited chok that teaches us about the nature of the whole Torah. And that is, in our minds, we differentiate between the rational commandments and the ones that we don't understand. But in reality, even the rational commandments, the source of our obedience is not necessarily our reason, but it's the fact that they came from God. And therefore, if one picks and chooses and says, I do the mitzvot that make sense, and I don't do the mitzvot that don't make sense, they're not really serving God. They're simply following their own rationality. So Chukat HaTorah says, the way you obey a chok defines your relationship to the totality of the Torah itself. And indeed, Rav Chaim Shmulevitz says a very beautiful thing. He says, people rebel against the chok precisely because it represents pure obedience. And human beings are stubborn. Jews in particular are stubborn. The Torah itself calls us Am Kishayorif. Now, that's a quality that has stood us in good stead all of these centuries, but it has a downside. We are a stubborn, stiff-necked people. Just attend a session of the Knesset, and you can see that. And a chok speaks to the natural rebelliousness of a person who doesn't want to submit to that which they don't understand. And Rav Chaim Shalevitz used to say that this is the meaning of a very interesting story. It's perplexing on many levels. He just takes on one aspect of it. You know, when David was fleeing from Avshalom, his son who wanted to kill him, so there was a man, Shimi ben Gera, who was a relative of Shaul HaMelech, who would be stoning David, and, you know, cursing him. And David's faithful general, Yoav ben Tzruya, wanted to kill him, and David said, no, David said, if God didn't want me to be cursed, he wouldn't have cursed me. So he accepted it with serenity, equanimity. That's a wonderful thing. We admire that. But strangely enough, on David's deathbed, which was not too many years later, David gives his final message to Shlomo HaMelech, his son, and says, hey Shlomo, this guy Shimi cursed me out. Find a pretense to put him to death. So all of that equanimity seems to have vanished on the deathbed. And that itself is very, very peculiar. I'll address that briefly later, because I want to get to the main point here. And Shlomo HaMelech needed a pretext to execute Shimi ben Gera. And the pretext was, he simply told him, hey Shimi, because you insulted my father, I'm not going to kill you for that, but I'm putting you under, not house arrest, I'm putting you under city arrest. Don't leave Yerushalayim. The day that you leave Yerushalayim, your blood is on your head, you will be executed. So, the story goes that obviously Shlomo was watching, had men that were watching Shimi. Shimi's donkeys were lost. Apparently many biblical stories are connected to lost donkeys. In fact, Shaul himself becoming king was based on the lost donkeys and going to Shmuel, the lost donkeys. Shimi looks for his lost donkeys. He, of course, gets apprehended by the men that are watching him. He gets executed. Now, Rav Chaim Shalevitz said, what type of stupid thing is this? A person is, I know, it's not like he was confined to a little cell and tried to jailbreak. He's able to stay in a city. He is told ahead of time, if he leaves the city, his life will be forfeited. He didn't leave the city to go to his mother's funeral or something like that. You know, he left the city to find donkeys. He was a wealthy man. He could have sent his servants. Why is he putting his life in his own hands for something that is relatively inconsequential? And Rav Chaim Shalevitz says, the answer is this. Had he not been told he could never leave the city, he wouldn't have left the city. He would have sent his servants. As soon as he's told you can never leave the city again, it becomes unbearable. He suffocates. He's choking. He can't possibly stay here another second. As soon as we're told we can't do something, there is an instinct in the human personality to rebel.
Adam and Chava and God.
That's right. That's right. Adam might have skipped the tree of knowledge had he not been told he can't do it. The good husband, I don't mean to be autobiographical, who is about to take out the garbage to help his wife, as a favor, as an unsolicited, unrequested favor. And as he's taking out the garbage, his wife's voice comes from the other room, please take out the garbage. There will be a little bit of a momentary, I don't like to be told what to do, you know. This is the meaning of the Gemara. The Gemara says that why is a bar mitzvah a simcha? A bar mitzvah is a simcha because until I was bar mitzvah, I was doing mitzvos as an eino mitzvah, a person who's not commanded. And now I'm commanded. So he who does commandments that they're commanded to do deserves greater reward than people who do commandments on an optional basis. Optional commandments are also worthy. They're worthy. They're spiritually worthy. But they're not as great as obligatory commandments. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. So Tosfos asks the obvious question. Perhaps we ought to say the opposite. If all I do is what I have to do, so I'm just doing my job, why should I get so much credit? But if I do more than I have to do, like time and a half for overtime, right? I get my normal wages for the 9-to-5 job or whatever it is. If I go beyond the call of duty, I get extra reward. So why does the person who's mitzvah gets more reward than anyone? So Tosfos answers psychologically, because as soon as you become mitzvah, your yetzer hara not to do it gets much stronger. And therefore, when I'm 12 years old, sure, I'll go to Minyan three times a day, and I'll, you know, learn the Mishmar, and I'll do everything. Once I got to do it, there is something in the human personality that rebels. We rebel against authority. We are stubborn. We don't like to be told what to do. We don't even like God to tell us what to do. And therefore, the chok is a very, very important lesson in obedience. But it's also a lesson in a subtle way, in resilience. How is that so? It's a very gentle reminder that there are things in life we don't understand. And that's an important lesson when we are confronted with tragedies, with events that we can't explain. And that's why there is a chok of the Torah and there's a chok of life. And from the chok of the Torah, we learn to understand limits on our ability to comprehend. And that in turn can give a person a perspective how to deal with reality. This is one of the Bali Mishra says a very beautiful explanation. There's a pasuk in Tehillim where David HaMelech says, "Zemirat hayu li chukecha." Your chukim were a song to me, the base migurai, in the environment of my terrors, my fears. So what exactly is the connection? So they interpret it this way, that when I am confronted with all of the fearful events in my life, and I don't understand, and I can't see what is God's purpose, what is God's plan, what is the meaning of this, and has God abandoned me, I contemplate the chok, the inexplicable part of the Torah, and that gives me comfort, that just as the chukim have a transcendent meaning that I don't understand, so too life experiences have meanings that I might not be able to gauge, but they do not represent abandonment. It's kind of an extrapolation from the chok of the Torah. Yeah.
In addition to what you said a few minutes ago about a chok, because of its inexplicable nature, having this sort of imperative, which wouldn't necessarily be the case with the Mishpat because we sort of understand.
Right.
Is there another way of being able to understand that? I don't want to call it a dichotomy, but that pairing, to say that although Mishpatim on the face of it appear to be rational and things that we can understand, in fact, they're not. Everything's a chok.
Yes.
Some of them are totally impenetrable.
Yeah.
And others you think that you've got a sort of handle on it, but you forget it. It's really not that.
That's probably a mistaken conclusion, Daniel.
Well,
it's not the moment in time to get into it, but the last half century or so, philosophy has been leaning toward the view that there are independent, objective reasons for not stealing, murdering, taking each other's wives, and so on.
That's very true, and indeed, let me just say though that nevertheless. The halachic details of even rational laws may sometimes have certain results that may not conform with rationality. In fact, that's the explanation that is given. Remember the Medrash that when Hashem offered the Torah to the nations of the world. So the nations of the world said, "What's written in the Torah?" So God said, "Don't kill, don't steal." And they said, "We don't accept that." Now, you could learn, well, that's because these are nations that like to murder and steal. But some interpret it differently, that they understood natural morality of not killing and not stealing, but they didn't want it to have a theosophic basis. They didn't want it to be rooted in a God command. They wanted it to remain in the realm of natural reason, because then you could make exceptions for abortion and mercy. You could make various exceptions based on your moral argumentation that might not necessarily be accepted as God's final word. So there is a concept that within the Mishpat there is also the chok that's there. So it's not an inconsistency. But there is another very interesting debate, and again, this is not the time to fully discuss this. And that is, should our attitude towards the Mishpat be that of a chok? Meaning to say the following: should my attitude is I don't murder, not because I think it's wrong, but because God has commanded me. And therefore, even those things that are rational to me, I am not behaving as a result of my rationality, I'm behaving as a result of unconditional command. Ad kidei kach, we even have some bizarre Hasidic stories. I mean, they're stories, so they don't represent any type of final Torah teaching, in which a certain rabbi, who was a very big Baal Tzedakah, he taught himself to be cruel so that when he resumed his charitable giving, he was doing it to serve God and not to assuage his feelings of compassion and sorrow. This takes it to the extreme that the value of a religious precept is precisely when you don't bring in your subjective rationality and feeling into it. Now, I would submit that that's profoundly wrong. And the reason is because that presupposes that mitzvot have no purpose other than doing designated actions. But if we look at mitzvot as vehicles for character transformation, it's impossible to say that it is desirable that I obliterate the character to focus on the act. That would be standing things on its head. In fact, one might say the purpose of the act is to generate character. That is what the Rambam says explicitly. In other words, let's ask a very simple question. We say it's good to be compassionate because that's one of the midot of Hashem. Am I compassionate because it induces me to do virtuous action? Or is it the other way? Does the Torah instruct me to do virtuous action so I should develop within myself certain elements of character? This is an ancient debate. It's called virtue ethic versus action ethic. Are virtuous actions desirable because they inculcate qualities of character? Or the other way around, are qualities of character desirable because they induce virtuous action, but essentially it's only the action that's desirable? The Rambam absolutely says that the purpose of external acts are not simply because, practically they're beneficial to the world, but they induce qualities of character.
So you got that from Aristotle.
Yeah.
Well, then the mitzvot's obvious.
That's
but
right.
There's another dimension to it, but even morality goes through different styles. The old with the Roman Empire today with the homosexual,
which was once universal. That's correct. In fact, that was really the basis of what you might call halachic positivism, meaning the theory that the only thing I should focus on is the act and not the character, was based on a fear that when you focus too much on the subjective ethical value, that is amenable to change with the times, etc. So really it was an overreaction perhaps to that notion of ethical subjectivity. You are correct, it is from Aristotle. Aristotle is very big on the development of character. In fact, the Rambam uses this for a bit of practical advice. The Rambam in Pirkei Avos discusses the following issue. If I have $1,000, I'm changing the amount of money, and I have a choice of giving $1,000 to one poor person or giving $1 to 1,000 poor people. The Rambam actually argues, since repetitive action has a more powerful transformational base of character, it is better to engage in multiple repetitive small actions than sporadic, occasional, large actions, simply because actions are virtuous not only because of the consequences they cause. You might say $1,000 in one place probably does more good, but because of the transforming of my character to be a virtuous person. And there the Rambam says small repetitions are more worthwhile. So that's a very, very interesting discussion. Should there be natural reasoning? In fact, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, Zichron Levracha, your neighbor, where he lived, Mamashir, well, a great privilege, wrote a very, very seminal article many years ago about whether halacha recognizes a morality that is antecedent to halacha. Meaning, is halacha the source of morality, or is halacha codifying, so to speak, a prior moral judgment that exists independent of halacha? And he points out, if you say morality only exists by virtue of the word of God, and there is no antecedent morality, then arguments that Abraham makes, that God is not behaving in accordance with justice, with Sodom, doesn't make sense, because justice is defined by God's will. we'll call that halachic positivism. Even in law, there's a whole debate. And if justice is defined in accordance with whatever God wants, then God, by definition, could not be guilty of injustice unless there's some pre-existing, which God authored anyway, but there's some pre-existing standard of morality to which even God, on some level, can be held accountable. And we find many things like this. So the Gemara says, Sodom and Amorah were destroyed because, and the Navi Yecheskel says, not because of sodomy, not because of all of that. They were destroyed because of their cruelty and their selfishness and their lack of compassion. Now, if you want to be a pure halakhic, and I look at what are non-Jews obligated, they're obligated in the Seven Commandments of Noah. I do not see charity listed on the Seven Commandments of Noah. They did not violate any halakha. So why are they being punished? The answer is, okay, there was no halakha. But they violated the basic decency that God expects every human being to understand by virtue of living in the world. Call it natural law, call it natural morality. But you do see there is an antecedent idea of morality that is independent of the legal halakhic requirements of either the Torah or of the seven laws of Noah.
Yeah. I remember Rabbi Bernstein from making the argument or giving an explanation for the expression Derech Eretz Kavnah Torah.
Yeah.
And he said that it's a matter of logic. He said that in order for the Torah to be given, there had to exist the idea of when Am Yisrael said we accept it, that they were bound to do that. That's something which precedes.
Some idea of living up to your promises.
That's right.
That's right. If there's no obligation to, Rabbi, great, phenomenal rabbi. Died tragic, relatively young. How old was he?
58.
Wonderful.
Rabbi Bernstein, from England.
Yes.
His son is my tenant.
Oh, okay, okay.
Yeah, it's the same one.
No, he's quite an exceptional.
Such vast implications. In terms of current understanding, about Goyim.
That's right. And again, this was Reverend's whole vision of life, that there is a morality, and again, Reverend was rooted in halacha and shas. He was a class, people don't know, he was a classic bucky in all of shas. I mean,
he took the position that there was no antecedent morality.
Did you remember that? I believe he came out the other way. I believe he came out the other way. Yeah.
But as Daniel just pointed out, that is a self-defeating position.
Yeah.
Because then it becomes impossible to give a reason why we should obey Hashem.
That's correct. That's right. That's right. That's correct. So, and once again, I think the short answer is that Torah is about character transformation and not just external behaviors. And as a result, therefore, we do have to look at, in every mitzvah, an abstractable value. In fact, I'll give you another proof within the halakhic structure. There is a commandment, according to Ramban, it's one of the 613 commandments, to go beyond the letter of the law. So to go beyond the law is part of the law. Now, going beyond the law is incoherent unless the law is there to teach me something. In other words, if the Torah says, give charity, and there's nothing in that statement other than the external act of giving charity, there's no value I can extrapolate to go beyond it. There is nothing in a law but a law. Unless, if you look at laws as vehicles of character transformation, I can then generalize and say, okay, the Torah gave me a law so I would be a certain type of person, so I will engage in other behaviors to try to achieve that same result. But that's only possible in a value orientation. It is not possible in a action orientation. Because in action orientation, there is nothing there beyond the law itself, beyond the naked act itself. I think that
even morality, there's regular morality, and then there's a higher level of desire morality.
That's right.
It's not obligatory.
But once again, by definition, that either comes from natural law or it's an extrapolation from the halacha. I'm actually saying two different things. I'm saying that there may be an antecedent morality, and there may also be supplemented by a moral structure that you infer from halachic detail. That's a little different, meaning even within a positivistic view of halacha, even if halacha is the source of morality, and I understand that's going to raise Daniel's conundrum, it is still going to be the case that it is not simply a source in terms of specific behaviors, but it creates a character, it creates a morality, it creates a vehicle of transformation. Okay. But now I just want to share with you one very, very beautiful beautiful thought. The paradox of Parah Aduma is the idea that the same thing that makes some people pure can make other people impure, and that seems to be a paradox. What does it do? By the way, just as a little joke, if you're familiar with NCSY, which has a small amount of activity in Israel, but it's mainly in the United States, it's the OU's youth division for teenagers. Mainly kids from public schools, kids who are not from religious homes, National Conference of Synagogue Youth. So it's done tremendous, tremendous work. Many years ago, I used to be involved with them myself. It's made kids religious and with enthusiasm, and many have gone to yeshivas, they've gotten married already. Some of them have grandchildren, it's been around a long time. But because it's a co-ed organization, and these public school kids, and boys and girls are together, a lot of socializing, and technically they're Shomer and Nagia, but the girls and the boys are a quarter inch apart, it's like they're not crossing, but they're right there. So yeshivas, mainstream yeshivas, don't like their students to participate in NCSY. Which is too bad, because in a sense the yeshiva kids could help, and they would also learn something from, because a lot of questions that people are embarrassed to ask in yeshivas, like how do you know there's a God, and these questions that they would say yerushalayim don't ask questions, in that forum people are free to talk about it. Even in Ur-Sameach we get guys who come from Mir, they come to hear these basic lectures on different issues. So my Rosh Hashiva had a very good witticism why he didn't like people to go to NCSY, because he says NCSY is like the Parah Aduma. It purifies the impure and it contaminates the pure. So he says, Baruch Hashem, for someone who comes from a non-religious background, it's wonderful, but someone who's religious, not so good. So he says Parah. So there are things in life that are like the Parah Aduma, indeed. But I want to share with you a thought of the Sfas Emes, and in a sense it's a little strange, because although this is said to be inexplicable, the Sfas Emes offers a bit of a perspective, and it's a fascinating perspective on it. And he says the following. Let's go back to why death came into the world. Death came into the world because the Nachash convinced Chava, and eventually Adam, that if you eat from this fruit, the fruit of knowledge of good and evil, you shall be like God, having a knowledge or a mastery of good and evil. Now, however you understand that very difficult enticement, Rav Tzadok says it was essentially the enticement of ego and kavod. Like, I offer you a God pill. Take this and you shall be God. It was egotism, arrogance, and hubris that brought death into the world. And that's not only in the nature of punishment, it's in the nature of consequence. Because man, in many ways, is godlike. We are made in the image of God. That does not mean physical. God has no image. But we have autonomy, free will, intelligence, creativity. We have a mastery over nature. We can create and destroy. We are godlike in many, many ways. Death is the ultimate reminder of the chasm that exists between creator and created. Death is a lesson in humility, a lesson in limits, a lesson in boundaries, a lesson that we are not God in spite of all that we can accomplish in a godlike way. So death is intimately connected to arrogance and gaiva, and that is why purification rituals are in the nature of humility and submission. Without explaining all of the details of the red heifer, the one thing that it does is it connects us with ashes. We put ashes on ourselves. Ashes is the sign of humility, submission, self-abnegation. When Avram pleads for Sodom and Avram says how utterly insignificant he is in his humility, he says, Anochi afar va'efer. So, if death comes into the world, because of arrogance and egotism, we become liberated from the tumma of death by humility and submission. Now, all of you know the famous Greek myth of the phoenix, which I shouldn't call it a Greek myth because Chazal have a very, very similar medrash about the netzpert, in which the phoenix is burnt into ashes and new life arises out of the ashes. Myths are very profound truths. You know, if you know Joseph Campbell, I mean, all myths. That's why when we say, you know, people sometimes say a certain Talmudic teaching is a myth. That is not necessarily a derogatory term. I mean, sometimes it's used in a derogatory negative way. But myth is actually what the Maharal would call an agada, that is teaching a deep symbolic truth that is not meant to be taken literally. And that is a very legitimate approach in agada. So myth is not a negative term. And the phoenix myth is expressing a great, great spiritual idea that we achieve life and renewal by self-abnegation and obliteration of the ego. Because when we are filled with ourselves and there is arrogance, there is no room for God, there is no room for growth, there is no room for movement, there is no room for constructive self-criticism or receiving the necessary criticism from others when that becomes warranted. So in a sense, we become self-actualized in the process of self-obliteration on one level. And that is why the purification rituals are, number one, the ashes of the Parah Aduma, and number two, mikvah. Mikvah, too, is essentially a destruction of the self. It's been said many times that the mikvah resembles the womb, where the baby is surrounded in water, and mikvah also represents, interestingly enough, symbolic death, because you are immersing yourself in water. Now, you cannot survive in that environment for more than whatever it would be, 10 minutes or whatever, or less than that. So essentially, it represents a killing of the self as a precursor to new life and new existence. So the Sfasemba says, again, I'm adding some stuff, that the concept of purification is liberation from the ego. And if I may quote an unlikely source, Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan, again, I'm not endorsing conservative or liberal politics, I'm not quoting him for any purpose of that nature. But he once said, there is no end to the good that could be accomplished in the world if we didn't care who got the credit. Ego is a real difficulty that we have. It prevents us from moving forward in so many ways. So that is the source of purification. But now I'm going to make two statements. You know, physicists say that there is matter and antimatter. So I'm going to make two opposite statements, and they're both true. One is, humility is the prerequisite for spiritual growth, self-actualization, closeness to God. Statement number two, humility can be the most destructive, negative, paralyzing force that exists within the human personality. Simply speaking, it comes in kosher forms and it comes in treif forms. There is a treif humility in which I regard myself as worthless, as insignificant, as not being capable. I don't recognize my strengths. I'm paralyzed with despair, indecision, and passivity. That is not a strength. That is a deep spiritual malaise. And then you will never become the person that you're supposed to become. You will not fulfill the mission that we believe each of us has in this world. It may not be a public mission. Sometimes the mission is simply to, you know, be a husband, be a father, be a wife, be a mother. Whatever the mission is. But I'm not going to be able to do it unless I see my value. So this might be the duality of Parah Aduma. Ashes are a sign of humility. But the same ashes, when taken in the right direction, elevates you, connects you, gives you self-transcendence. When taken in the negative way of self-loathing and self-disparagement, can make you impure. Same thing. It moves in both directions. And therefore you have to know. And indeed, this is encapsulated in the very famous comment that many people think is a medrash. It is not. It is from the 19th century Chassidish Rebbe, Rav Bunim of Pashischa in Poland, that a person has to have two ideas in his pocket at all times. One is, I am dust and ashes. The other is, because of me, Bishvili, Nivra Ha'olam. God made many elephants and many dogs and many cats. Only made one human being, maybe two, maybe one woman, one man, depending on the account. And the reason the Mishnah gives is that each person should say, the whole universe is justified because of me. Now that's not arrogance, because the same way the universe was created just for me, was created just for you. So it is not a basis of looking down at anybody. But it does highlight the idea that a person has to know their strengths and work with their strengths. And humility is not about self-disparagement, and it's not about looking at yourself as worthless. It's about acknowledging that all of us have gifts and all of us have talents, but Hashem gave it to us to be used in positive and constructive ways. And that is why ashes could be the most important thing in life and the most destructive thing in life. It all depends in which way you move it. The great, great Baal Musar of Yeruchim Lubavitz, I don't know if all of you have heard of him, but Yeruchim Lubavitz was the Mashgiach of Musar in the Mir Yeshiva in Europe. He died at the beginning of the Holocaust, and he was a person who had a profound influence on thousands and thousands of students, one of the great, great Baalei Musar. In fact, it's interesting, Rav Shlomo Volba, who might have been the last great Baal Musar, who just was Nifter just a few years ago, he was a student of Rav Yeruchim in the 1930s. And he used to tell the story that on the first day he came to Mir from Germany, which is unusual. Germany did not have the great yeshivas there. When he came to Mir in Poland, a man with a long beard went over to him, an avrech, a kollel person, and said to him, "How old do you think I am?" So Volba said, "Well, I don't know, you look like you're 30. He says, "Nope, I'm only 2 years old." So Volba said, "I don't understand. What do you mean you're only 2 years old?" He said, "I met Rav Yeruchim 2 years today. And that is when I was born as a human being. I was born as a human being." This is how profound his influence was. So he once said, again, it's a thought, he once said, a person who does not recognize his flaws is a fool. You think you're perfect, you know, you're just crazy. But a person who does not recognize his greatness is a tragedy. Because he'll never have the tools to become the person that he's supposed to become. And this, I would submit, is the paradox of Paraduma. Now, this also explains an interesting enigmatic comment that Rashi brings from in the name of Rav Moshe Hadarshan. Rav Moshe Hadarshan is otherwise relatively unknown. He's not Chazal. Apparently this was a preacher shortly before Rashi, who was very well beloved. We don't have any work of Rav Moshe Hadarshan. We know him from Rashi, who quotes him several places. But he always has very interesting drushas. And he says, paraduma. Paraduma is a kapara for the cheta ego. Just like an ego, when a child messes up in a house, the mother has to clean up. So the ego, when the calf created all this havoc, the para, the mother, has to clean up after the calf. And he connects it all to the cheta ego and the light. So I would suggest that this really fits the Svas Emes very nicely, because the cheta ego ultimately was also a sin in misplaced humility. Because it's very clear, both the Kuzari and the Ramban explain that they did not believe that the golden calf was the God that created heaven and earth. They made this calf. Huh? They would not think that. But rather, they looked at Moshe as a spiritual intermediary that channeled divine energy to them, because they were not worthy of a direct relationship with God. And therefore, when Moshe doesn't come down in time, they need a Moshe substitute, not a God substitute. And therefore, in a sense, the cheta ego was not only a sin against God, but it was a sin against a denial of the value that you have in having a direct connection to God. It was misplaced humility. So by engaging in a ritual which highlights the dangers of misplaced humility in the sense of mitamei es hatahorim, they are rectifying the error that they made in the cheta ego itself. So that might be the source of why it's an atonement. But again, as I say, I'm always reluctant to give reasons here, because Paradigma has reasons we're not supposed to understand. But interestingly enough, I'll leave you with one medrash, and I really don't have that good a shot here. According to the medrash, the one person who mastered the inner meaning of Paradigma was none other than our friend Korach, who took it with him to the grave last week. And it is said that he had the wisdom of actually penetrating into the inner dynamics of Paradigma. So,
Did
you want to say one thing before I?
He died the week before the Pasha, but actually, that's
true. But if you learn the Gemara, you actually, this is an example of Ein Mukta Memucha B'Torah, because in Parshas Baloscha, when the Levium were purified, he says they were sprinkled with Mechata. So this is an interesting example where the details were not given until later, but so it must have been. Yeah, just this final little question, which is not the.
The Torah says Shlomo
didn't know. So Shlomo didn't know. Shlomo didn't know it, but Korach knew it. That was the one thing. All right. So Shlomo overall was wiser, but Korach had one certain thing. You have this sometimes. There was a man in Yerushalayim who wasn't famous, but he was a phenomenal bucky in everything. Bavli, Yerushalmi, Medrash, Zohar, he just knew every bit of data. So every Purim, he would go to Rebbe Yashiv, and Rebbe Yashiv would say, "Tell me something I don't know." So the person would come up with obscure Midrashim and all sorts of things, and most of the time Rebbe Yashiv got it, but he always got Rebbe Yashiv with something that he didn't know. So even though this person was probably not as great in his mastery of all of the Torah, Rebbe Yashiv, but he knew avenues that Rebbe Yashiv did not know. But this is the last question. I just want to address it a little bit, because it's an interesting question, and that is, David HaMelech is praised because of his equanimity, his acceptance, his unwillingness to engage in revenge. The fact that he says to Yoav, "Do not touch Shimi ben Gera. If God has wanted me to be humiliated and cursed, I will accept it without complaint." And then he turns into, you know, the Havdol, the Godfather. Get rid of him, revenge, and the like. So how do you understand that? So one of the explanations that's given, you may like this, you may not, is that David HaMelech did not want to act out of anger, revenge, and personal vengeance. But, as a matter of principle, he who disparages the king does deserve to die, because that is setting an example of disrespect that is against the Torah itself. So as a result, David HaMelech deliberately, in the heat of the moment, when emotions were strongest, he would not act. But when he was calm, collected, he then made a rational decision that this needed to be done. I once heard from the Bussner Rebbe, that's how Rav Levi Yitzchak was, the senior Bussner Rebbe, who was Nifter, when he lived in Boston. I used to spend Shabbos there when I was in law school. So he said that his father, who was the first Bussner Rebbe, used to hit him when he misbehaved. But he always waited 24 hours after the event. Now, I heard from a child psychologist that she very much disagreed with this, because a young child doesn't remember what he did, the day before. They don't have a memory of time. But the rationale of the father was, I am not going to hit you or discipline you because I'm angry, because I'm upset. That would be a form of child abuse. I'm angry, so I'm going to hit you, even yelling. I'm angry because I'm going to yell at you. I have an obligation to discipline you and to guide you, but I'm going to do that when I make a calm, collected, non-emotional decision that this is the appropriate punishment or discipline that you need. That was the cheshbon. So David wanted to kind of act in the same way. That's one of the answers. Okay, anyway, thank you very much, Daniel. Please thank you, Robertson, for us. And have all a wonderful Shabbos. Okay.
Well, thank you guys for opening